The problems of philosophy begin with a discovery or an exploration of what the word philosophy actually means. To many people in the British Isles, it is a rather foreign word, primarily because it is very seldom taught in our schools, and the consequence is that people feel that to be a philosopher or to do philosophy means having an extra brain or an extra head even. The word itself comes from two Greek words, philo, meaning to love or to like, and sophia, which means wisdom. Which may not be saying very much, but at least it's suggesting to begin with that you have to put your head into gear before you try to talk about philosophy. It's not just things said, as it were, off the top of your head. It comes from the early Greek of classical Athens, where the word itself was included a mixture of all the disciplines that one would study. When Plato, for example, in his Republic, talked about the philosophers being the ideal rulers or governors of the state, what he meant was people who had studied broadly in all the subjects that were available to be studied. They would have studied the sciences, the arts, law, and so on. The full curriculum. So that really a philosopher was one who was a polymath, as we'd say today. Now, what has happened over the centuries is that the vast bulk of these subjects have, so to speak, fled the nest and become independent subjects in their own right. And in any school or university today, you will study English, history, geography, the language, modern languages and ancient languages. You'll study the sciences, chemistry, biology, physics, and so on, all in their separate faculties. And the question that therefore arises is, to what extent philosophy, which at one time subsumed them all, remains an independent subject to study in its own right? And that's really what I'm trying to defend today, why we should still study philosophy, which begins by discovering what philosophy actually is. Now, there are people, and some of them are those who have been philosophically trained, who would say that really philosophy doesn't have any distinctive role and therefore can be allowed to be dropped. And there was a period when philosophy departments in universities were closed or drastically cut down. I want to suggest that philosophy still has a major contribution to make for human well-being, and I will divide what the grounds for saying this into three. At least I think it's three, we shall find out. And the first is, and I was hinting at it a moment ago about putting your brain or your head into gear, that philosophy trains you to think clearly about what you're saying, to express yourself at the same level as those that you are speaking to or writing to, so that there can be a genuine communication between you. Now, there's a lot I could say about this, but I just want to deal with what I think is probably the most important aspect of this process, which is recognizing the distinction between factual statements and value judgments, what you might loosely call opinions, between factual words and evaluative words. Let's begin with words. I could say that the shirt I'm wearing at the moment is a mixture of red and white. And anybody observing this would, no doubt, unless they were colorblind, come to the same conclusion. I'm dealing there with factual words. I can say that the room I'm in is roughly 3 yards by 2 or 4 yards by 2. And again, if you wished, you could come in and check whether what I'm saying is accurate or not. These are words that are easily understood and about which there's going to be no big debate. But supposing I were to say, coming back to my shirt, that the shirt I'm wearing is a good shirt. What am I then saying? You may look at it and decide you don't like the pattern, you don't like the style. It doesn't look well on me. It's not me, as people will say. Well, there would be might be some debate. I don't think there'd be a very long debate, because I don't think it's a subject worth debating for a long time. But there might be some debate. And whenever the word good is used, or bad, or the words ought, or ought not, we're then in a world where it is not so easy to come to an agreed conclusion, or even to be arguing, as it were, from the same premises. I mean, let's just take this word good. Let's just keep with that for a minute. We use it all the time. But just think of the contexts in which it could be used. I could say that a book I'm reading, let's say The Mayor of Casterbridge by Thomas Hardy, is a good book. I could say that Peter Ustinov is a good man. I could say that the knife that I have in my pocket is a good knife. Now, when I say those things, you're going to say, or anybody will say, well, I'm not sure whether that is the case or not. It depends, really, what exactly your definition or the requirements that you have in mind are when you use the word good. If I talk about a book as a good book, then really, in order to be able to see whether they agree with me or not, anybody discussing the matter with me would have to ask, well, what qualities are you looking for in a book in order to be able to give it the designation a good book? Is it characterization? Is it narrative? Is it style? And so on. All sorts of questions that can be asked about any work of literature. And until we've decided on those criteria, and those might be open to debate, in fact, almost certainly would be open to debate, then the question as to whether this particular book lives up to these criteria cannot really be resolved. Let's go on with this word good. I can talk about somebody. Well, let's give him a name. Joe Bloggs. Joe Bloggs is a good burglar. Let's go even more outrageous and say Sergeant Kluger is a good killer. And I think those two examples bring the point home that the word good is meaningless, and I mean meaningless, in itself, until we decide whether what the criteria are which are going to get this label. It's really, as it were, a medal for doing what a thing or a person is seen as being ideally performing. A thing that does what it's made to do. A person who does the things that he is trained or expected to do by others. So that Sergeant Kluger is the sort of guy, if you're fighting a war, you'd want on your side and not the other side. And if you did happen to want a bit of burgling done, Joe Bloggs is your man. He will not get caught. I don't know whether the point is coming out, but what I'm really getting at is that the difference between a factual word and an evaluative word, between a factual statement and a value judgment, is that the factual words and statements are capable of being verified, and the value judgments or the evaluative words cannot be verified. Let's just go on to some statements. Let's give you a factual statement. A factual statement, here it comes. Los Angeles is south of San Francisco. Now, somebody else who doesn't know their geography might well say, well, no, I disagree. Los Angeles is north of San Francisco. Well, you could argue that for a long time, but in the end, the matter can be resolved very simply by getting out an atlas and show that, in fact, it is something between 400 and 500 miles south of San Francisco. That is a statement that can be verified and therefore is a factual statement. Incidentally, just rather cunningly, a factual statement in philosophy could also be one that isn't true. It would still be a factual statement if I said that Los Angeles was north of San Francisco. It wouldn't be a true statement as opposed to false. It would be a false statement. But it would still be factual in the sense that it is a statement whose truth or falseness is open to verification. And that is true of all factual statements. By looking up in a dictionary or an encyclopedia or an atlas, you can decide whether this issue of debate, which side has got the right answer. But with evaluative statements or value judgments, this is not the case. And this is where philosophy has a major contribution to make, because it's saying that a lot of the decisions we make and the statements we often proudly affirm are nothing more than value judgments, where it may be an opinion, but it is not a fact. And a lot of people don't seem able to realise this. After all, they are surrounded every day, aren't they, in their newspapers by statements purporting to be facts, but which are, as a matter of fact, value judgments. Let's just think of one or two value judgments. Homosexuality is unnatural. Now, some people will say this so strongly that with giving the impression that anybody who disagrees with that must need their head, quite literally, examining. And yet, when you examine it as a statement, what is it really saying? Homosexuality is unnatural. What does the word unnatural mean? You may say it involves sexual acts which are incapable of bringing forth children. Well, there are plenty of sterile people who are incapable of doing that, and how many times during heterosexual activity, how many times is a child the thought that is in the mind of those participating? The word unnatural easily springs to lips, but it is not easy to be defined. The same would be true if we're talking about a garden. I would just ask you to ponder on what is the difference between a weed and a flower. So we've got this first step, and it is a major step, because we are, as I say, constantly surrounded by and are constantly making value judgments. Now, as long as we realise their value judgments, that's fine. But many people don't realise their value judgments. They make statements about people of other nations. They will talk about the whole nation as having a particular sin, like the Scots are mean, the Italians are lazy. And so that sums up millions of people, and we've got them all in some nice little pigeonhole. We've got them exactly where we want them. These kind of judgments don't help in international communication, and the similar kind of judgments, I suggest, don't help in communication between individuals. And this is therefore the first lesson, and I would think a highly important lesson that people gain or learn from studying philosophy. Philosophy will say, watch your words, be aware whether what you say can be verified. If it can, fine. Shout it from the rooftops if you like. But then if it can be verified, it's probably not worth shouting from the rooftops anyway. There is a form of philosophy which says we should not discuss any issues which cannot be verified. It's called logical positivism, and it had its heyday in the 1930s, 40s and 50s. But of course that would mean, if you're going to discuss things that cannot be verified, that you're therefore excluding from all discussion topics that do have to do with morals, about human behaviour, to do with politics, how a country, a state should be governed, to do with the arts, what is it that makes a work of art, and why does one work of art seem to be preferable to another, and of course with religion. These four areas, politics, philosophy, morality, art and religion, are the most fascinating areas of discussion, but nothing that is said in them, or no judgment that is made in them, is open to verification. They are all value judgments. If you're studying morality, there is no right with a tick or wrong with a cross answer. If you're studying religion, there is no religion, although plenty of them claim to be, no religion which has the final truth. If you're studying art, you cannot say that one particular composer, shall we say, is better than another. You can say, in my opinion, he is better, or in my opinion, or according to my taste, I enjoy this guy more than I enjoy anybody else. Well, that's fair enough if you say that, but then to go on to say, this person is the greatest composer. There is this Peter Ustinov I mentioned earlier, describes in one of his, described in one of his television broadcasts, a school he went to where he had a German teacher who taught music. And his first, he was only eight, I think, at the time, and his first question, he says, was, just said, who was the greatest composer of all time? And he said, even at that time, I thought this was a damn fool question, but I thought I'd better put some answer, so he wrote down Mozart. And the teacher came along, put a big cross against it, said, wrong, it was Beethoven. Now, just to tell that story is to get you laughing, because it is so absurd to say that one is right and one is wrong. You cannot reach a conclusion about that, but that doesn't mean, I would suggest, that you cannot discuss it. And that's why these discussions of these non-verifiable areas of human thought is always the most interesting discussion, which is why I find those societies such as Round Table and Rotary, which say you can come and talk, but you must not talk about either religion or politics or morals or even the arts. I simply have to ask them, well, what else is there left to talk about? So philosophy is concerned with the most interesting areas of life, and looking at them through the eyes of one who realizes the difference between a value judgment and a factual statement. Well, that's the sort of basis. We could then go on from there, because people might say, well, that's all very well, but surely a communications department, such as some universities have and a lot of schools have, can do exactly the same job. And I suppose to a certain extent it can, and might. Of course it might not, and it wouldn't have to. In philosophy you have to. But let's go on. I said earlier that, to begin with, in ancient Greece, or classical Greece, let's call it, philosophy took on board all the subjects, and that since then most of them have fled the nest. Well, yes, they've fled the nest, but they still bear the mark of their parent. In other words, philosophy still keeps a hold on all the subjects that have become independent. So that if you're studying philosophy, you could study, for example, philosophy of science, philosophy of art, philosophy of literature, philosophy of music, philosophy of law, it's called jurisprudence, philosophy of religion. You can study philosophy of any subject. Now, why is this? Basically, it is because every subject proceeds on certain bases which themselves are not verifiable. Now, that may sound a bold statement to make, but I'll illustrate it by looking at one or two of these subjects. The philosopher is around in these subject areas to ask the question, well, What do you mean when you're saying this, or on what authoritative basis are you making this statement? Let's take a very simple example. Mathematics uses the symbol zero. Without zero, you couldn't do maths, and you couldn't do computing. But there is no such thing as zero. Zero is nothing, and nothing doesn't exist. So, there's a book just come out entitled Zero. When it was invented, we're not quite sure, a lot of debate about that, it's very ancient. But the philosopher says you've invented something which doesn't exist in order to give substance to what you are now engaging yourself in, namely the immense, diverse world of mathematics. Marvellous world, but it is built on something which does not exist. Its foundation is non-existent. So, what is the value, asks the philosopher, among other things in mathematics, of the process that you're engaged in? Or philosophy of science. What is science? Is science, it literally means knowledge. Is it knowledge? Is it eternal knowledge? There was a time when some scientists perhaps still say that what we've discovered is eternally true. Philosopher says, what do you mean eternally true? Well, it's a law of nature. A law of nature. So, at one time, and not all that long ago, speaking in historical terms, not all that long ago, it was a law of nature that the Earth is flat. It's only in the last, some people doubted this thousands of years ago, but it's only generally been accepted since the discovery of the telescope in the 15th century and the realization that we've got our sort of spheres wrong. There is a flat Earth society still flourishing in the United States, but I don't know that it flourishes anywhere else. I think most of us would accept that of increased knowledge, which has come about as a result of this invention, has made us reject that idea. So when scientists talk about a law of nature, a philosopher of science will say, well, don't you mean that this is how we see things according to our present knowledge and the aids to knowledge that we have been able to construct up to now, but that we might have to change our mind on this? And if you, the whole history of science is a changing of minds, of which the Darwinian discoveries of the 19th century in the evolutionary process is just one major example. So, again, the philosopher is entering into an area which by itself doesn't seem to be philosophical, but is showing that philosophy has questions to ask and a contribution to make to the better understanding of that area of exploration. And there have been great philosophers of science in our own time, of whom Karl Popper is perhaps the most famous. He argued that the whole it can only be a scientific statement, any statement you make, if it can be falsified. There's a thought. In other words, challenged and shown to be wrong, so that you then go on to look at something else and be able to express what you think to be the case more accurately. Well, let's take a couple more areas in this, because this is really quite a very important part of philosophy, and if you were studying for a philosophy degree, you would have options between these subjects presented to you. Philosophy of art, usually called aesthetics, not to be mixed up with ascetics, though the artist might himself be an ascetic, a self-denying type. But aesthetics, the theory of beauty, what makes a work of art? What is the difference between a poem and a piece of doggerel? What is the difference between music and a piece of cacophony? What is the difference between a painting and a daub? Now, some people might say that anything that we create, whether it's musical or written or visual, is a work of art. Well, if that's the case, then the phrase work of art doesn't have much meaning if everything that everybody does and says and thinks and shows is a work of art. Then it downgrades it. Traditionally, we have seen a distinction between that which is a work of art and that which is not a work of art. And what the philosopher asks is, where does the distinction lie? And we could go into lots of debate about this. Is it popularity? Does it, if a lot of people like it, does that make it a work of art? Well, if that were the case, the greatest painting in the history of painting, according to the number of prints of it that have been sold, is Tretyakov's Green Burmese Lady. Where I come from, in Blackburn, they've sold, I think, about 2 million of these alone. They've taken them off the walls now and put them in their attic for good luck or something, but you used to see them in every household on the living room wall. Millions and millions of copies of this, far more than anything that Rembrandt or Leonardo or any other great painter has ever produced. Popularity may mean that a particular generation likes it, but then it might just as quickly decline in popularity. And there you've got another problem. Because if you're going to say, well, we can only know over a period of time, let's say we won't know whether this is a real work of art for another century, that means that none of us at this present time can make any pronouncement about it at all. We'll have to wait and see, but none of us will be around in a century's time. An interesting example of waves in appreciation of, in this case, a poet, is Robert Browning, who was looked upon as a major poet in the 19th century during his lifetime, and then went through a period in which he was relegated down to second class, if not below that, and is now, in the present time, just coming back into his own a little bit more. Mind you, anybody who writes "Oh, to be in England now that April's there," remembering the April we had last year, one must have doubts about his common sense, but poetically he has, I think, a great deal to contribute. But the point I'm making is that there are, as it were, moods, phases, fashions in the arts. For about a century after his death, for example, Johann Sebastian Bach's music was hardly played at all until Felix Mendelssohn, in the 19th century, came along and rediscovered him. And today, many people would put Bach at the top of their list. But, as I say, for a century, his music was hardly heard. When I talk about a work of art, what exactly am I talking about? What is the role of the critic, the specialist, and so on? Is it a work of art if I like it? I know what I like, people say. And that, for me, is a work of art. Is there any sort of objective standard? Should we be teaching children only those things that come into some kind of special collection of poems or of plays or of paintings? Or should we allow them to spread more broadly and not worry about having a hierarchy in the arts? So it's a fascinating point. And it's a major issue in our schools and indeed in our universities at this time. The one I like best here, in terms of those subjects where philosophy asks questions about the subject, is history. You see, history is built. You can't write a history book unless you say there is a theme running through history. The question is, who creates the theme? In the end, you have to come down, I think, to the fact that it's the writer, the historian himself or herself, who creates the theme. And this is illustrated by the fact that two historians writing about the same period will come up with a different theme. You read, for example, A.J.P. Taylor on the Second World War, and then read Trevor Roper, his colleague and contemporary at Oxford, writing on the same subject. And one would be forgiven, I think, for getting the impression they're writing about two different worlds, never mind two different wars. Or let's take Richard III. Like many people, I was brought up to look upon him as an absolute villain. The guy who, whenever he saw an uncle turn him upside down in a vat of wine, and the moment he clapped eyes on a nephew, smothered him. Habits you'd have thought his mother would have got him out of at a very early age. And then along comes Josephine Taine, famous as a detective novel writer, but also famous as a historian, who wrote a book called The Daughter of Time. And she gave evidence to show that, in her opinion, the real character of Richard had been destroyed by destroying the documents that showed him up in a completely different light, destroyed by those who took over from him, namely the Tudors, who were responsible for the murder of the princes in the Tower. And Richard III, in fact, was potentially the greatest king that this country would have ever have had. And there is a place in the King's Road, Chelsea, where you can meet with others in trying to resuscitate Richard III. The latest book about Richard III, written a few years back by the Professor of History at London University, is entitled Good King Richard. Now, who's got it right?
What about Neville Chamberlain?
We think of him as the guy who was duped by Hitler, waving his silly little piece of paper in 1938 at the London airport, where Hitler promised to be a good boy and so on. And we've seen him as being feeble and really responsible for leading us into that war. But I know of one historian who is writing a book to change that picture entirely by suggesting that Chamberlain knew all along what Hitler had in mind. He also knew that Britain was not ready to face him because we hadn't rearmed during the 1930s, and that what he was doing as Prime Minister was engaging in delaying tactics while we quickly got as many arms together as we could so that when war eventually came, we would be ready to face him, at least for a time. And I spoke to this guy and asked him whether he really thought that was the case. He said, "Of course I don't believe that. It's a load of rubbish. But it's got it published." And he was really expressing the fact that if you're going to write a book of history, the only reason for writing another book about a period that's already been written about is to say something new about it or to give it a different slant. Now, the question that anybody reading history has to ask is, which of them is the right slant? And the philosopher will want to ask that and come up with the answer, no doubt, that there is no right slant. There is just the slant as each one sees it. After all, each historian comes into a period that he or she is studying with their own separate background and perhaps set of prejudices, ways of looking at things, and making therefore their own conclusions as to whether X led to Y or whether Y would have happened independently of X. This is the stuff of history, and it's fascinating. As one of my colleagues said to me, if that were not the case, we would all be out of work. If there were such a thing as the standard work, shall we say, on the English Civil War, then nobody would ever need to study it again if it had already been written, everything that could be said about it. And it makes you wonder how far, then, really, a history book is similar to a historical novel. I asked some historians whether they didn't look upon themselves as failed novelists, and they didn't take this as an insult. They saw this as highly complimentary to them. Really, the philosopher will ask, is there any real difference between a history book and your daily paper? In your paper that today, there will no doubt be stories about perhaps 500 or 600 people, but there are 6 billion people in the world, and yesterday something happened to every single one of them. There were thousands of deaths and births and people getting married and divorced and murdering and being murdered. Lots of people changed their jobs, changed their homes, changed their clothes, bought new clothes. One could go through the whole list. Obviously, a lot of things not very interesting to most other people. But something happened to everybody, and any newspaper is simply selecting those which the proprietors of the newspaper, those who run it, believe will be of most interest to its readers. Now, is there any difference really, except in scale, between that and the history book, where the historian, out of all the things that were happening, and all the people who were around, selects a certain number of each and puts the pattern together as he or she perceives it? So, when you read history, what are you reading? And this is then the second area of philosophy in which a philosopher contributes to these subjects by simply asking questions about, not making assertions, but just asking questions about the bases on which these subjects are built. The assumptions, in other words, that underlie the study of any subject. Okay, you might say, well, that's 2 points you've made. Is there... But you see, you could have, in this second one, you could have the philosopher, not as a philosopher, but as a historian working in the history department, a scientist working in the science department, and so on. Except that a philosopher is not necessarily a trained historian, or a trained scientist, or a trained artist. He's a trained philosopher. He's trained to think along these lines. But he could still be placed, it might be argued, and often this is the case, he could still be placed in the faculty or the department of that area in which he's asking his questions. A philosopher of science could be placed in the science department, and so on. All right, fair enough. Is there then no subject that one could say belongs to philosophy per se? That is to say, entirely on its own. That without a philosophy department, this subject would not be taught. Well, I want to suggest three areas where this is the case. There's a fourth one is logic, which obviously is going to aid you in your thinking, linked probably with what I was saying at the beginning, but I can quite understand that logic, whether philosophical logic or symbolic logic, could be taught in a mathematics department. I can accept that that is the case. And, in fact, if you study maths, you are studying one of the major expressions of logic. So we'll put logic one side, while not denying that it is of great value that people should learn to think in that way. But there still remain three other areas, and I want to name these. The first is epistemology. I'm very sorry about the word. It simply means the theory of knowledge. When I say I know something, what exactly am I saying? What is it to know something? Does it mean that it's true? Not always. Some people might say, I know there are fairies at the bottom of my garden, but not many people would believe that what they're saying was true, even though it was true for them, or they accepted it as true. What is the weight? What is the strength of the word to know? I remember a woman years ago who was quite convinced that her dead uncle, who'd been dead for years, was still sitting on top of the wardrobe in her living room. She was quite convinced about this, to the extent that she would never make a decision without saying, I'll have to ask my Uncle Bob. Now, if you said to her, well, there's no Uncle Bob sitting there, she'd have looked at you as if you were insane. There's a turn up for it. She knew, and got the word in inverted commas here, that he was there. Other people say they know that we have been visited by beings from outer space. They know, they have seen flying saucers. They know this. There are millions of Americans who know, so they say, that they have been transported by these alien beings to some other world beyond our firmament and returned back to Earth again. They state quite plainly, yes, I know, this has happened to me. Other people say, I know that God exists. I know that Jesus rose from the dead. I know that Michelangelo was a great artist. We use the word know in many different ways, and philosophers will ask, well, how do you know, and what is the strength of what you know? And there are two basic issues that arise. Is knowledge born of experience, or is there what they call technically a priori knowledge, knowledge that comes through reasoning alone? And there have been philosophers on both sides who have argued the case. The great empiricists, those who believe that knowledge comes from experience, are Berkeley, the Irish bishop, John Locke, English philosopher, and David Hume, a Scottish philosopher. They argue that our knowledge can only be sure if it is based on what we have seen or heard or felt, what we have experienced ourselves. Other knowledge is just speculation, they argued. But the rationalists, as they're called, argue the opposite case, that we can know things a priori. These are people like Descartes and Spinoza. I can have knowledge of my soul, said Descartes. I know, I think, therefore I am, and I have this immortal soul within me, and I know this. I don't You can't say I have experience of it, but I know that this is the case because I know it deep down within myself. I know, said Spinoza, that God is nature and nature is God. I suppose one would say in the end that you need a bit of both, but the debate is fascinating and one that any philosopher would be engaged in at some point of his studies. Now, I don't know where else you would discuss this subject except in philosophy. You might say it could be discussed in the psychology department, because one of the questions that is asked is there a difference between the mind and the brain? What is the link between the mind and the brain? Is the mind simply the brain looked at from a different perspective? Or is the mind something that will survive? It lodges, as it were, with the brain, but in the end is independent of the brain and will survive after the brain itself, made of flesh, will decay. Well, it might be taught in a psychology department, but the psychology is the understanding of the mind. And this kind of issue would certainly be a very secondary one in a psychology department. It's not their business to look at these kind of matters. The only place you could be sure that epistemology was taught, I think, would be in a philosophy department. Let me come on to the two, which probably bring us nearer to the kind of questions that you and I frequently discuss. The first is ethics, the theory of right and wrong conduct. How do we know what is right and what is wrong? Where does the source of our awareness of the difference originate? Are things always right or always wrong? Or is there a sort of mix? Should we say that in certain circumstances this would be the right way of behaving, but in other circumstances it would not be the right way to behave? Does the end justify the means? Is it morally right to do something rather nasty to somebody else, like punishing him severely, in order to deter other people from doing what he has done? How far is a human being made, i.e. fixed in some way by his society or his own past history, the subconscious that Freud talks about, or by God, or by the natural world around him? And how far is he a free agent? Are we free when we make a decision to have done otherwise? If we are, then perhaps we've got to justify that. We can't justify it because we can never prove it. If we're not, then you've really got to ask, well, what's the point of blaming or praising anybody for anything if they couldn't have done other than what they did because of forces over which they had no control? Then how are they individually to be held to account? And these issues in ethics they affect us all. This is the great thing about ethics. Everybody has to be involved in making moral decisions. You cannot avoid making moral decisions. The way you treat other people, even on a casual basis, is a habit born of earlier moral decisions. We're making them all the time. Now, I don't know again where this should be discussed other than in the philosophy department, or through the aegis, if you like, of philosophy. It's been suggested it might be taught in a sociology faculty or under the umbrella of sociology. I don't think sociologists would be concerned with these questions. They'd be concerned with questions as to why certain societies have certain values and other societies have different values, and looking at it all from us on that social basis, as the title of their discipline suggests. Again, it might happen that if there were no philosophy at all taught anywhere, that these kind of issues would be raised in the sociology departments. But you could not be sure. The only way you can be sure is by having a philosophy department, which is why I think that we should be teaching philosophy in schools, because otherwise, where are you going to be sure that our children are brought face to face with some of the moral dilemmas of our time, which are often more complex than even our adults, certainly as expressed in some of our newspapers, allow for? So that's two areas. The third is metaphysics. The word metaphysics came into being after the death of Aristotle, when his students were sorting through his voluminous writings. He'd written about the physical world, which explains the physics bit, but he'd also asked questions about what might be loosely called the spiritual world. Was there such a thing? Have we summed up the whole of life, the whole of the universe, when we talk about matter? Is that enough to explain everything? In other words, is there anything else after the physics, which is what metaphysics literally means? And this remains a question which has occupied human beings since before, and certainly since Aristotle's time. Have we said enough when we've described the physical world? Or is there another dimension to the world? Is it a monistic situation, i.e. just one entity, matter? Or is there a dual entity, matter and spirit? That is the central theme of metaphysics. In fact, the person who, I think, put the questions most clearly was, strangely enough, a politician, Franklin Roosevelt, President of the United States for 13 years, who in the early 1940s made a speech in which he said there are four questions that every human being must discuss if he's going to be said to be truly human or not. First of all, is there a God? Secondly, has man a soul? Thirdly, is there a life after death? And fourthly, is there a purpose in life? Now, we may say they don't make presidents like that anymore, but these are the issues which, if you were studying metaphysics, you would study. In fact, I think the most central question of metaphysics, and one that might keep you awake at night if you wish to ponder on this, is the question, was the universe intended? And all your Hawkinses and all the other astrophysicists who are speculating or discussing the origins of the universe and the black hole and all the rest of it, they can give their opinion on this, but you can give yours. Was it intended? If it was intended, who intended it? What was the intention? How do we discover the intention? How can we be sure, when two different people differ as to what the intention was, which of them has got it right, if any? And so on. If, on the other hand, we say it wasn't intended, then we've got to say with, for example, Bertrand Russell, who said the whole of the universe is the result of an accidental coming together of atoms, which had no preview of the end that they were achieving. That no power, no heroism, no intensity of thought can preserve an individual beyond the grave. But what he describes as all the noonday brightness of human genius is destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system. In other words, eventually all our strivings will have been buried eternally, and it will be as though nothing had ever been, and nothing that we've been anxious about and shed tears, spilt blood, all those things will have become as nothing. Well, there is a different way of looking at it, and metaphysics invites you to do just that. Now, you may say, well, surely these metaphysical questions could be discussed in a religious studies department. And I suppose they might. But if you're going to such a department, a theology department, as it would be, The risk is, and it's more than a risk, but the risk is that you are going to count that the conclusion is established before you actually debate it. Theology actually means understanding of God. And it would be a strange theology department, wouldn't it, that actually came to the conclusion that there was no God. They'd almost be doing themselves out of a job if that were their conclusion. Well, I am not saying that metaphysics and religion don't have a link, but I think that metaphysics is more neutral on these matters and than is theology, and therefore ideally taught in a philosophy department. Now, there are three subjects which I think make up justify the continuing existence of philosophy as a discrete subject. And it is, I would like to see it actually introduced in schools, possibly to replace religious education. I would rather we discussed the values that the various world religions have brought to human beings under the neutral umbrella of philosophy than under the, by its very name, special pleading umbrella of theology. Because I feel that with philosophy we have the means of expanding our minds and being able to look at a different point of view from the one that we have held, be able to accept that on some matters we need more thought, more knowledge, more information, more time to work our way through these complex problems that everybody has to face in life. And I think that this was all extremely well expressed by a philosopher I've just named, Bertrand Russell, an English philosopher, died in the 1950s, who wrote a little book called The Problems of Philosophy. He wrote it in the first decade of the last century, and it's still being reprinted. And the great virtue of Russell's writings is that a non-specialist in philosophy can read and understand these complex issues, and that is a very rare gift. And in the final paragraph of this small book, The Problems of Philosophy, he wrote this: philosophy is to be studied not for the sake of any definite answers to its questions, since no definite answers can, as a rule, be known to be true, but rather for the sake of the questions themselves, because these questions enlarge our conception of what is possible, enrich our intellectual imagination, and diminish the dogmatic assurance which closes the mind against speculation. But above all, because through the greatness of the universe which philosophy contemplates, the mind also is rendered great, and becomes capable of that union with the universe which constitutes its highest good. This little book, The Problems of Philosophy, was on my father's shelves, and of the many things I'm grateful to him for, the fact that he possessed this is one, because I took it in my late teens and it opened my eyes to a universe greater and vaster than anything I had previously been able to imagine.